From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book about anxiety, the journalist Scott Stossel reveals it all about his own experience. He's had panic attacks. He's had breakdowns on plane flights. At times, he has difficulty breathing or swallowing or walking. He has all kinds of fears or phobias, claustrophobia, one about vomiting, and he's tried all kinds of drugs. But nothing has fundamentally reduced the anxiety, he says, is woven into his soul and hardwired into his body. Stossel will join us today to talk about anxiety, the history of it, the medical part, the cultural part. Really, it's his way of coming to terms or maybe finding the benefit in being a quivering, quaking, neurotic wreck. My Age of Anxiety, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Scott Stossel has been getting a lot of attention with his book about anxiety. Much of it is because of his honesty. He reveals his own experience. Since the age of 2, he writes, he's been a twitchy bundle of phobias, fears, and neuroses. He almost fainted at his own wedding. He's frozen at public speeches. He's had breakdowns during job interviews. Thousands of times, he says, he's been stricken by what he calls a pervasive sense of existential dread. So his book is his attempt to explain anxiety, how it works, how we talk about it, what we do about it. It's about the treatments, the drugs, the therapies, the way it can cripple some people, but also the way it drives and motivates others. The other reason the book is so popular, of course, is because so many of us at varying degrees can relate to Scott Stossel's experience. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about the book. It's called My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. Scott Stossel is the editor of The Atlantic magazine. We've got a link to on our website to an excerpt from the book, by the way, that appeared in the Atlantic's January issue. And we'll give you details about that as we go along. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Scott Stossel, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to begin. You've talked a little bit about this, of when this idea first came to you, because as I understand it, it kind of occurred to you as you were writing, well, you'd finished your book before. You had a previous book, and you were about to embark, I guess, on this book tour, which terrified you. It's not a pleasant experience. And this is when you started thinking about writing your own book about this idea of anxiety?
That's right. I mean, the irony is it was about 10 years ago, and I was just had finished my first book about Sergeant Shriver, who was the founder of the Peace Corps, and I was gearing up for a, you know, moderate big book tour that included some, you know, national TV appearances and lectures before large audiences. And I was, you know, I'd wrestled already at this point in my life with anxiety for 20 years, but I was sort of consumed with anticipatory anxiety about what the book tour would entail. And sort of in desperation, I was already in psychotherapy. I was already on some medication, but I went to two different therapists, one specializing in cognitive behavioral therapy, one who was a psychopharmacologist, and sort of casting about. And it was during this moment that I was thinking, you know, actually, maybe there's a topic for a book here. And in fact, partly out of craven desperation to get in to see the cognitive behavioral therapist quickly,
yeah.
I, in my note that I sent to the center, I said, you know, maybe this is something that I would write about. I was a journalist at The Atlantic at the time.
Yeah.
And that was when the seed was planted. And then I spent, you know, much of the next 10 years sort of gathering evidence, doing reporting and reading around extensively. And, you know, of course, the irony now is that here I am 10 years later, I finally finished the book and I'm rewarded with another book tour.
Yeah. It's so interesting because you write about, you mentioned it was April 2004, 2 o'clock, where you actually presented yourself to the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders at Boston University. I mean, I'm not sure if you had written it down or it was just something that was implanted in your mind.
No, well, I actually tracked down, you know, partly what I was doing, you know, in the book, I really do try to combine I didn't set out to write a memoir, but I wanted to use my own experience, sort of, you know, using myself as a case study, as it were, and a jumping off point for going into all these other aspects of anxiety. So I approached the study of my own anxiety. Obviously, a lot of it is sort of personal reminiscence, but I also sort of was reporting on myself. So the reason I knew the exact time is I actually retrieved the medical records from my visit to, this was the Boston University Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. And so, you know, I actually have the exact time that I appeared there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had also tracked down as part of my research the records of my great-grandfather who suffered acutely from anxiety. So I remember actually that it was in the afternoon, but the only reason I knew it was exactly 2 o'clock was because I sort of approached it as a reporter, as I would if I were reporting on someone else.
Yeah. Well, that's the balance, right? I mean, that's, I think, the thing that interested me about that is that you didn't set out to make it a memoir. But I guess at some point you must have realized, I'm not sure I can really tell the story fully if I don't invest myself in it, telling the personal part of it.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I always intended, I knew that telling a little bit of my own story would lend, a human face and hopefully make the science and the history and the culture that I was talking about relatable. But my intent originally going in was maybe to have just a little bit about myself in the introduction by way of saying, you know, I know whereof I speak in a kind of, you know, subjective, experiential kind of way, and then mostly talk about, I hoped it wouldn't be dry and academic, but in a kind of more dispassionate clinical way. But as I went along, I realized that, you know, the subject of anxiety is so vast, and I wanted to cover so many different angles on it, the philosophy of it, the history of it, the cultural history of it, the scientific history of it, and it threatened to kind of sprawl all over the place if it didn't have a unifying strand. And so I realized that unifying strand could be me, since I'm 44 years old. I've struggled with this for probably 42 of those 44 years and have, you know, gone through generations of different kinds of therapy and different kinds of medication. So I realized that I could use myself as kind of the through line narrative. And again, starting out, I didn't intend to have nearly as much of myself in the book as ended up in there. Yeah. My editor kept encouraging me to put more and more of myself in there. And the funny thing is, you know, people say, I talk in the book about how ambivalent I am about putting so much of myself out there, and, you know, also just about, in effect, coming out as anxious. I'd hid it for 34 years ever since I'd been diagnosed. And the truth is that, you know, for so long, I worked on the book for so long, I thought, well, I'm never going to actually finish this. And so sitting in my study, typing away, I thought, well, no, this will never see the light of day, so I might as well throw in this, you know, yet one more kind of additional embarrassing story about myself, almost to keep my editor entertained. I don't think I could have sat down. You know, we ended up running this extract in The Atlantic, which was kind of the distillation of all the most florid personal examples of my own anxiety. I couldn't have sat down to write that knowing that it was going to show up in, you know, the living rooms of 500,000 people and, you know, be read by millions of people online. Mm.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that pretty much since the age of 2, you've been, as I said, that twitchy bundle of, you know, phobias and fears and neuroses. And it seems like they blossomed at this really young age. I think you were 10, you said, when you were taken to a mental hospital for evaluation.
Yeah, I mean, my parents finally realized that I had this. I mean, you know, since, as you say, since the age of 2, I'd been sort of, you know, a neurotic, inhibited, very, very shy kid. I had acute separation anxiety at that age, which is a typical developmental stage. It's normal, you know, for kids to be scared to go to school when they're 2 or 3. But there are, you know, I was sort of on the extreme end of it. And then what was different for me was that separation anxiety persisted fairly acutely, you know, past age 2, 3, 4 into, you know, 5, 6, 7 into elementary school. And then I developed this acute phobia, emetophobia, which is the fear of vomiting, that was really started intruding on my life because I would worry about it all the time. Right. And if someone, had a stomach virus at school or in my family, you know, I would just be unable to function. And so I think I was about 10 years old. It was when they took me in, and that's when I was first diagnosed. And then a couple of years later, and I went into psychotherapy at that point with one of the psychiatrists who evaluated me at the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I started at a new school when I was 12, and that was sort of the first, you know, real breakdown. And, you know, in January, this would have been 1982 when I was in seventh grade. And I don't know what the constellation of factors that threw me over the edge. It was, you know, adolescence, being at a new school. It was winter, but there was one night when I came home in the middle of January and was sort of just screaming uncontrollably, just you know, completely ravaged by anxiety. My parents sort of didn't know what to do. And that was the point at which, I began my lifelong experience with psychopharmacology, and I was prescribed Thorazine, which is, you know, at the time sort of a major sedative. Now it's sort of considered an antipsychotic, and Imipramine, which is a tricyclic antidepressant drug. And for the next 2 years, I was on those and sort of, you know, managed to stay in school and out of the hospital. But that was the beginning of when it became clear I really had, you know, a disorder that was a kind of mental illness or a disease that needed to be managed.
You know, you've talked about that one particular phobia, the fear of vomiting, emetophobia. Your mother had it. You have it. Of course, your daughter has it. And you've said that this phobia metastasized into a whole range of other fears. Is that how it works? It starts with one thing and then it kind of grows and builds?
Yeah, that's very typical. I mean, when they study, in effect, kind of the, you know, life course of anxiety, often for kids, you know, kids who have acute separation anxiety and then develop, say, a phobia of dogs, mm-hmm. assuming, you know, I mean, sometimes the phobia of dogs is legitimate because they get bitten by a dog,
sure.
But say there's a dog phobia, that kid is that much more likely than average to, in their teenage years, develop, you know, sort of social anxiety, and then that much more likely in turn as a young adult to develop panic disorder, and then if not treated, you know, that much more likely to end up having troubles with depression and addiction and, you know, to have all these other kinds. So this is one thing, one conclusion I sort of take away is that there's a doctor, Ronald Kessler, who studies, does these large-scale epidemiological studies of anxiety, and he says, you know, early intervention is very, very important. And a big project of his is trying to get schools to be better at identifying the anxious kids, because it tends to be, you know, the kids who have anger management problems, mm-hmm. the kid who mm-hmm. have ADHD, you notice them because they're causing trouble. The kid who's shyly sitting in the back not saying anything but is, you know, quietly miserable is actually not going to get noticed and maybe not treated. But in terms of, yeah, you mentioned that both my mother and my daughter had it. I mean, my assumption, you know, growing up and as I embarked on the research of the book was I assumed that I'd learned this anxiety from watching my mother. My mother's a very anxious personality herself, has an anxious temperament, and had this acute emetophobia and germ phobia when I was a kid. So I just assumed, you know, through the phenomenon known as psychological modeling, mm-hmm. I saw her having this anxiety. I sort of adopted it as my own. So then, you know, I'm working on the book, and when my daughter was in first grade and 7 years old, which was more or less the exact same age I was when I developed the phobia, someone got sick at school, and she suddenly developed the phobia very acutely, you know, stopped eating, was afraid to go to school, was upset all the time. And it was heartbreaking to see, and also just sort of puzzling and fascinating because, you know, I consciously, because I thought I'd learned the anxiety from my mother, had thought to hide it from my daughter, and yet here she was developing it at exactly the same age. And so in my chapters on kind of, you know, nature versus nurture, I puzzle with the question of, you know, could something as idiosyncratic and weirdly specific as emetophobia be passed through the genes? Did I somehow unconsciously transmit it mm-hmm. To my daughter, or is there some kind of constellation of genetic factors that don't necessarily lead necessarily to emetophobia, but fears of loss of control and having a generally anxious temperament, you know, make you more predisposed to develop that particular anxiety?
I want to break some of that down as we go along. I wanted to talk a little bit about this idea of hiding your anxiety and this, because you do talk about it like coming out in some ways. What is it that you're worried about? I mean, obviously, I guess in part you're worried that people are going to find out about your anxiety and whether there's going to be the stigma attached to it. But is there something else going on there that you're going to be revealed to be? You know, I think a lot of people worry that they're going to be found out to be this massive fraud, you know, that we don't have it to be the editor of The Atlantic or whatever it is that we do. I mean, is it a specific thing that you worry about in terms of hiding it, or is it just a bunch of things?
It's a bunch of specific things. And I mean, as you say, you know, there's sort of this imposter syndrome that, you know, many people struggle with where, you know, you'll be revealed as a fraud that you're not, you know, competent to do the things you have been appointed to do. Actually, there's a new book that's not out yet, but it'll be out in about a month called The Confidence Code by Caddy Kay and Claire Shipman that talks about how actually this is more common in women. And they talk about the relationship, you know, in the workplace, confidence ends up being more important than competence, which is not the way that it should be, but, you know, why this stuff kind of matters. But for me, you know, it always... My family always tried to hide the fact that I was in psychotherapy and going through these various treatments. And you know, shame does still, or stigma still attaches to various forms of mental illness. And I sort of always felt that shame. I worried in kind of practical terms, you know, the irony is that at work, you know, I was seen as sort of unflappable and imperturbable and, you know, not anxious to a degree I actually hadn't realized until the book came out and everyone was so surprised to hear that I struggle with this stuff. Yeah. So I worried that, you know, would I be compromising my professional abilities and standing if everyone knew sort of the stew of anxiety that I'm dealing with in my head all the time, not to mention revealing all these embarrassing episodes. There was this quote that I came across, this, you know, fascinating quote from World War II about this sign that was posted on the gun sites, Allied gun sites in Malta during the Second World War. And they said, if you are a man, you will not allow your self-respect to show signs of an anxiety neurosis or to show fear. And, you know, militaries have very good reasons for not wanting their soldiers to develop outward signs of fear because it can be contagious. But to me, I felt like, you know, this is what society believes. You know, both for men and women, there is stigma attached to mental illness. But for men in particular, there is this stigma of, you know, is being, if you have an anxiety disorder, are you a coward? Mm-hmm. You know, you're afraid of things. If I am, you know, more afraid of going on a chairlift or a merry-go-round than a six-year-old, you know, a three-year-old girl, does that make me somehow less manly? So I was sort of wrestling with all of these issues. And my therapist in the book, Dr. W, you know, and this is, I talk about this in the book, he kept encouraging me to, you know, come out with this. This right. will help you, you know, ease the burden of solitary suffering, and you'll help other people too, because they'll be able to see, you know, you are an outwardly capable, high-functioning person, and, you know, this will give them hope and strength as well.
You say in the book, despite the advances in science, you know, drug technologies and our studies of the brain, that there's still a lot of disputes about what causes anxiety and how you treat it. What's the central dispute? Is this kind of boiled down to a question of whether it's a medical illness or a philosophical problem? Because you write a lot about that.
Yeah, I mean, and the disputes can be overblown. I mean, I think this, in some ways there's a convergence. You know, the more and more that we learn about neuroscience in particular, you know, there used to be a big gap between, you know, Eastern medicine and Western medicine, and, you know, Western bio, sort of the biomedical model that involved a lot of medications, and Eastern medicine involved meditation and acupuncture. And, you know, there was no previously, you know, Western science never studied those Eastern things. And it now turns out that, you know, you can look at people who are really good at doing mindfulness meditation, which is sort of an Eastern technique, and see that there are structural changes in the brain that take place. You know, for instance, the size of the amygdala, which mm-hmm. is sort of the seat of fear in the brain, actually shrinks in people who, you know, practice meditating for 28 days. And that correlates with a self-reported improvement in sense of well-being and reduction in anxiety. Though the changes that are being wreaked by this, you know, just your own mind over matter, are as real as the changes that are being affected by, you know, medications' effects on various neurotransmitter systems, or in severe cases, you know, electroshock therapy or things like that. So in some ways, there's convergence, but there is within the field disputes between, you know, people who are sort of pro medication and believe that, you know, medication can be the most effective way and can actually cure mm-hmm. various forms of mental illness. And there are those sort of ideologically on the other side who believe that at best, the medications only mitigate the symptoms or mask the symptoms without at all treating the underlying, you know, psychological or philosophical problems at the heart of it. And at worst, these critics argue, they'll say, you know, they actually make your problem worse because they cause dependency problems, or they make you more anxious, or, you know, you end up with increasing dose dependence, or prevents you from directly confronting your anxiety and really dealing with the underlying problems. I sort of stand in the middle. I mean, I respect the concerns of the anti-medication zealots and believe that, you know, probably the drug companies and the insurance companies and the FDA, you know, have expanded the disease categories too broadly, so that now there are a lot of people who are being medicated who don't necessarily need to be. But on the other hand, you know, speaking as someone who has taken, you know, many medications on and off for the last 30 plus years, they can work for some people some of the time very, very effectively. And even if it is only managing the symptoms, you know, that can be the difference between having a normal life and being kind of curled in a ball in your bed and not able to function. So, you know, I have found them very helpful at times in my life, even though I've also struggled with, you know, very bad medication experiences, where the ones that didn't work, and horrible withdrawal of symptoms and that kind of thing.
You write about the cultural part of the story. I was interested in you say also that the anxiety and its disorders represents the most common form of officially classified mental illness in the United States. And you say this is not just an affliction for Americans, of course, but I did wonder if it was something related to Western culture or developed cultures or, you know, industrialized societies. I mean, people wonder, is it related to the fact that the pace of society these days?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, it's a little hard. And I went in, you know, fascinated by these questions because, I mean, on the one hand, you do find high rates of anxiety everywhere in the world, you know, depending on how you measure it. And I to some degree, I believe that a sort of genetically programmed biological disposition toward extreme anxiety is sort of, you know, woven into some fixed percentage of the population, you know, that's relatively fixed across the world and across history. But that said, you know, they do find interesting differential rates, like Mexico, where the quality of life is lower, the material standards are lower, actually has lower rates of reported anxiety than here. There are differing rates around the world. And so, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell, is that because of differing standards of definition, or are there actually some cultures that are more relaxed? And there is some evidence that actually developing countries, which, you know, have more real hardship in some ways, have lower levels of anxiety. And so maybe that means, A, that sort of the sorts of neurotic anxiety that afflicts people with anxiety disorders is a luxury that you have when you live in a, you know, capitalist Western world that's, you know, got political freedom. Or it could be that, you know, the rate of change and, you know, obviously for the entire world, but for the United States, there's been so much economic uncertainty, so much rapid technological change, so much social change. And I actually, perversely, you know, we have so much political and economic freedom compared to, say, people in the Middle Ages. And that's a net benefit in you know, almost every way, except maybe, you know, there's a psychologist at Swarthmore named Barry Schwartz who talks about the paradox of choice. And in some ways, you know, the very abundance of choice is incredibly anxiety producing. And whether that's something as trivial as, you know, you walk into the supermarket and there's 57 kinds of cereal and you have to decide which one to get, you don't want to get the wrong one, or seven kinds of shoes. But to more significant questions, like, you know, in the Middle Ages, you were born and you didn't really decide what you were going to be when you grew up. You were born into the role you would inhabit for the rest of your life. And your life was probably miserable and short, but you weren't worrying about, you know, what college do I go to? What career do I choose? Should I be a stay-at-home mom? Should I be a stay-at-home dad? How do I balance work and family? What's my personal brand? You know, all of this stuff contributes to anxiety. So I do think that we live in a particularly anxious age and in a particularly anxious country.
Scott Stossel is with us. His book is My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today's program may interest some of you who suffer from some form of anxiety disorder, and maybe you haven't come out with it yet to friends or people at the office. Maybe it's not that extreme, but maybe you have panic attacks or get anxious about public speaking or mingling at a party. The journalist Scott Stossel hid his anxiety for years, but now he's written a book about it, not just his own paralyzing fears, but the nature of anxiety, the genetics of it, the history of it, how it fits in the culture. The book is called My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. He's joining us. We invite you to join us as well if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. So you write about the fact that it's a mix of things. It's in part it's genetic, in part it's environmental. I want to ask you about the genetic part a little bit about this, because, mm-hmm. because of course, we've talked a little bit about how this runs in the family. You mentioned your mother. You write a bit about your great-grandfather, who was dean at Harvard College, went through this series of really serious breakdowns later in his life. But it's important to say, and we'll talk about the genetic part, but I need to come back to the fact that you keep saying that it doesn't mean you're doomed to grow up this way, that there are genetic factors, but there are other things which we'll get to. But talk about genes, if you would, first.
Sure. Well, no, I was, one of the questions, basic questions I wanted to answer and wrestle with in the book was the nature-nurture question, you know, and in effect, again, using myself as a case study, but then jumping off from there to talk about the general literature, you know, what are the different – there are so many different theories of what causes anxiety or what the nature of anxiety is. And I wanted to sort of try each of them on in turn. So actually, you know, in the book I spend one whole chapter talking about the talking about my separation anxiety and the history of what became known as attachment theory, yeah. which was developed by a British psychoanalyst in the 1950s named John Bowlby. Which has now grown up and it's a, you know, a huge field. And basically, it sort of builds on kind of modified Freudian idea that your early experiences with your primary caregiver, almost always the mother, have an incredibly powerful formative effect on your adult level of security in the world and baseline levels of anxiety. And you know, he has all this evidence about kids who are separated from their parents for brief periods of time as a, he studied kids during World War II. And then he developed these experiments where he would actually study how mothers and babies interacted. And did they have, sort of a secure attachment style or a sort of ambivalent attachment style? And, looking at this over 50 years, found that there was a profound correlation between kids who had sort of insecure attachment relationships with their mothers grew up to become, anxious adults. And and there's even animal studies to support this, rat mm-hmm. mothers that lick and groom their rat pups more, those rat pups that have been licked and groomed more as infants grow up to be less anxious rats. And you can see this both in their behavior and if you look at their HPA axis, which is, sort of the hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal axis, they have just like a more settled physiology. So I go through this whole chapter and conclude, well, clearly then, I had a very, very overprotective, anxious mother. Mm-hmm. It's like Freud said, it's my mother, caused my anxiety. And then I go to the next chapter, which is all about genetics. And where I actually come down is, there's just been an explosion of research onto the genetics of anxiety. But, going back millennia, Hippocrates and Robert Burton in the 17th century observed, that temperament is clearly hereditary. We've all seen that, a hot-headed mother or father will often have a hot-headed kid, and there's now tons of studies showing that once you have a few instances of, say, anxiety disorder or depression in a family, the incidences will just like multiply many-fold. And as you say, I sort of struggled with, in the book, I talk about my own conversations with Dr. W, where I'm sort of haunted by the example of my great grandfather, who was, highly successful man, dean of Harvard College, as you said, and then, but had always had a nervous temperament. And in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, just had a series of breakdowns where he was hospitalized multiple times, had to undergo electroshock therapy, and was never quite himself again. And so I look at him and think, there are certain outward similarities between him and me, and we share certain genes. Am I doomed to his fate, or if I didn't have access to the modern medication that I do, would I have ended up like him? If he, in the 40s and 50s had access to the medication that I had, would he have been okay? Impossible to answer all these questions. But I look into actually some of now researchers are looking into all these what they call candidate genes, mm-hmm. Specific genes, the variant of which will determine certain aspects of brain function, whether that's, how efficiently serotonin gets transferred between the synapses of your brain or dopamine or other things. And it's really striking. Some of these studies are finding that, if you have certain versions of the serotonin transporter gene, you'll either be, much more resistant to or much more susceptible to developing anxiety disorders. There's a neurotransmitter that's less familiar than serotonin called neuropeptide Y. And there's this fascinating study I came across. A guy studied Army Rangers and Navy SEALs who go through the SEER test, which is this sort of incredibly grueling, multi-day test where they're trying to, winnow out all but the, very strongest of the Navy SEAL and Army Ranger candidates. And they're, exposed to sleep deprivation and, borderline torture techniques and, long walks carrying packs. And the fascinating thing is that this researcher figured out he could predict in advance who would survive and who would break down based on the levels of neuropeptide Y in their blood. And neuropeptide Y itself is, other evidence suggests is genetic. So you start to think, well, geez, it's all genetic.
Yeah.
But it's not all genetic because, on the other hand, if you look at a pair of, say, identical twin set. If one member of that identical twin set has panic disorder, the other member is, you know, many, many, many times more likely than an average member of the population to develop panic disorder, but not guaranteed to, which, you know, sort of proves that there are elements above and beyond genetics. And, you know, so there is, I think, you know, your underlying genome sort of fixes your temperament from almost from birth. But then on top of that, there is your upbringing. Have you been exposed to trauma, luck, you know, the life circumstances you live in, and how well do you learn to cope with these things? So you're not, you know, you need to be careful. And I had to guard against this myself of falling into the belief that genes are destiny. And I did get myself tested for a couple of these things. And one of them, you know, I do have the anxious version. And I was thinking, like, would it be a relief to find this? Because it would explain, like, oh, this is why I'm this way. See, it's not my fault. I can now, you know, can I go curl up in bed and watch TV shows? Or would I have felt even worse to find that, like, I actually had the genes for a non-anxious temperament and I've somehow managed to squander, you know, a good genetic inheritance?
It's interesting. I wonder, is there any way to, I don't know if this even sounds scientifically possible, can you synthesize, you know, this neuropeptide Y and give it to those of us who are anxious, and then maybe even then talk about, develop a, so take care of that part and then develop a behavioral strategy, talk to the parents about the way you, you know, I mean, can you kind of fine-tune this process, figure this out?
Researchers are working on that now, and I can't remember if there's what the specific studies are, but they're, you know, but both, you know, academic researchers and for instance the military are looking at all kinds of ways to, you know, how can we come up with better ways of both measuring and predicting anxiety. You know, the army's interest to know, like, when is a soldier's levels of this stress hormone getting too high, so we can pull them off the battlefield because they're going to break down and make bad decisions or develop PTSD. And by the same token, yeah, they're looking at everything, you know, neuropeptide Y, all of these different genes. They're now getting better at being able to tell, like, if you have this constellation of genes, you're more likely to respond more positively to medication A than to medication B. There's a lot of research in that area, and so, you know, it's exploding all the time. And I mean, in some ways, you know, Tom Insel, who's the head of National Institutes of Mental Health, talks about how anxiety is one of the most exciting areas of research, just because it's advancing so rapidly, and they're, you know, finding out so much about the link between sort of molecule and emotion, or gene and temperament, and all this. But in some ways, too, it's still, we're kind of groping in the dark. I mean, you know, how all of these neurotransmitters and cells in your brain come together to create not only, you know, your level of anxiety, but your personality and yourself and free will. We really are, you know, I think we'll look back a few hundred years from now and think how primitive the research was.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the good part of anxiety, the adaptive, you know, part of it all. Are those of us who are anxious, have anxiety disorders at, you know, varying degrees, are we more sensitive? Are we more aware? Are we, you know, are we better workers?
There's some evidence definitely that that's the case. And let me start by saying that, you know, anxiety itself is normal and adaptive. I mean, basically, you know, whether you're talking about a panic attack or sort of a anxious response to a phobic stimulus, that's basically the fight or flight response, or a version of it, just firing inappropriately at the wrong time. And, you know, in the state of nature, or you know, in modern times, there are, you know, the fight or flight response, which, you know, causes blood to flow away from your stomach and you perspire and your, you know, pupils widen so you can actually, you know, perceive things more. These are actually adaptive things. They enable you to, you know, flee or to fight if you're in that situation. The problem is when this starts firing in an inappropriate time, it's sort of a evolutionary adaptation gone awry, and it can be quite a miserable experience, and then it's not helpful. But there are definitely ways with, you know, people who are anxious, A, they're, you know, less likely to engage in risky behaviors. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to take care of their health. So, you know, if you're looking at hiring people from an actuarial perspective, the anxious ones will last longer. There's also, you know, about in 1908, I think, 100 years or so ago, there was a famous study by two Harvard psychologists, Yerkes and Dodson. And basically, they looked at animals and humans and found that there's kind of an optimum level of anxiety. You know, obviously, if you're too anxious, your performance will be impaired because you won't be thinking straight, and your body will be sort of being, you know, going crazy around you and you won't be able to function. But if you're not anxious enough, and that is to say, you know, you don't have a little bit of adrenaline coursing, then you're not going to be as effective at whether it's you're taking the bar exam or giving a talk, because you won't have that level of modest physiological arousal and engagement. And that's, you know, true of all people, you know, whether they suffer from anxiety disorders or not.
Yeah.
As to the question of whether are there redeeming qualities associated with anxiety disorders, there may be. I mean, there's I talk in the book about Jerome Kagan.
That's a really interesting one. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's probably the world's foremost expert on temperament. He was a Harvard psychologist. He's retired now, but studied it for 60 years. And he talks about, you know, people sort of occupy this range from, you know, an introverted to extroverted temperament, or inhibited temperament to extroverted temperament. And people with inhibited temperaments are, you know, tend to be shyer, more retiring. They, you know, have a stronger physiological response to stress. But what he found is, you know, by the end of his career, he was hiring only inhibited temperament people. Who are also more likely to develop anxiety disorders and depression. He would hire them because they tended to be more conscientious workers. They were less likely to make mistakes. So, you know, this is, you know, again, you know, one mark in favor of anxiety. There are other things that may be associated with it, too. I mean, there's all kinds of evidence. You know, Aristotle was probably the first to cite, you know, there is, postulate about, is there a link between various forms of mental illness and creativity, mm-hmm. And artists? And, you know, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that is, in fact, the case. And with anxiety in particular, you know, anxious people are very good at imagining horrible, catastrophic scenarios. You know, the therapists tell me, you know, if you want to hire, if you need a lawyer, hire an anxious lawyer, because, you know, a lot of his patients and his unhappiest patients are lawyers, but they're very, very good for their clients because they are always worrying about what the worst case, you know, the many worst case scenario eventualities that could develop, and are good at, you know, preparing for those. And then, as you mentioned, you know, it may be that there are, you know, particularly for people with social phobia, if it's acute, you know, they tend to be much more attuned and empathetic and, you know, aware of what other people are thinking, sometimes wrongly so, about how people are perceiving them, but they're you know, they may be better at foreseeing conflict and being able to avoid it, and just you know, diffusing you know, personnel problems in an office, in, you know, more than in somebody who has, you know, of low anxiety. They may be, you know, have almost like a blunted social antenna that makes them less socially sensitive. So there's lots of things like that. There was another study called "Can Worriers Be Winners?" That showed that, you know, maybe during the financial crash, you know, it might have been a better thing if there were more anxious money managers, because, again, you know, the ones who were more prone to anxiety were more cautious and less, or, you know, more risk averse, which, you know, would have been a good thing in that situation. And, you know, there's even, you know, there's one gene called the COMT gene, which has been called the worrier gene. Yeah. And, you know, there's two variants of it. One is the worrier gene, and if you have that variant, you tend to be, you know, less anxious and be able to perform well under pressure. But if you have the worrier gene, you're actually better at, when things are calm, at avoiding danger and at, you know, thinking more creatively in certain ways. So there are many ways in which there, you know, anxiety, if anxiety itself can be adaptive, and then there are things that maybe come along with part of the kind of overall personality package of anxiety that are good, and that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily want to give up entirely.
Scott Stossel is with us, the editor of The Atlantic magazine. His book is called My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. I took a few of your calls when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with journalist Scott Stossel. We're talking about his book, My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. Let's go to the phones. Amy is with us in Salt Lake. Amy, hi.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for taking my call. And sure. Scott, thank you so much for being willing to share your story. I really appreciate this.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, I have a company that I created about 6 years ago called Yoga Me Do. And the whole purpose of this company, it actually operates in two of the schools within the Salt Lake City School District. And the whole purpose is, number one, to kind of get nutrition into the education system or into the curriculum, but number two, to be able to help children build preventative mental health skills through kind of yoga and some fun cardio and some focus games. And I'm wondering, through your experience, do you feel like something like this would have benefited you in an elementary school setting?
You write about how you don't just need a drug to boost your NPY levels. You say meditation, you mentioned that earlier in the program, works.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that yoga and mindfulness meditation is effective, definitely in adults. And of course, the irony, you know, and I've dabbled with both yoga and various forms of meditation. And of course, you know, the irony is that the people who need it most are the worst and least persistent at doing it. I do think, you know, that there is evidence that can be very helpful for kids. And I was saying before, you know, in general, if you have kids who are, you think may have incipient anxiety disorders, you know, getting them some kind of treatment early, and whether that's yoga, cardio, I mean, all that stuff is shown to be effective, or, you know, what's known as cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, you by all means should. So that sounds like a really interesting program and one that may, you know, be very helpful to kids.
It's a similar question Michael asks. Suffering from moderate anxiety since he was young, he's found that exercise, particularly aerobic exercise, is extremely helpful. Kurt sends this. He says, I've always wondered if increased anxiety disorders or anxiety disorder diagnoses, if any of that is shown at all to be linked to the increased likelihood for drug addiction, those abusing drugs trying to self-medicate their own untreated or severe anxiety. Is there a connection?
Yeah, I mean, there's particularly with all forms of anxiety disorder, as with depression, you know, there's a very elevated risk of also developing drug dependence or alcoholism. With social anxiety disorder in particular, I know, you know, because people are anxious about going to social situations, they'll start relying on alcohol or other kinds of medication. And, you know, if you're prone to addictive behavior anyway, that's a very dangerous combination. And so it's, you know, that's... treating social anxiety disorder is, you know, just to alleviate the symptoms of it is reason enough to treat it. But another reason is to head off the addiction and alcoholism that can come along with it down the road.
Mm. You're right. It's that genes are not our destiny necessarily. We have this capacity, as you say, for neuroplasticity, the ability to carve out new neural pathways. How do we go about that? I guess the question of mindfulness. Paying attention to, I mean, what can you do?
Well, there's lots of different things that you can do. And one of the, I think I mentioned it briefly earlier, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is, it's been around for a little while now, but it's still sort of seen as one of the cutting edge and most effective therapies, not just for anxiety, but also for depression and even things like insomnia. And that basically is, you know, trying to take advantage of the idea of neuroplasticity, but to retrain your brain. I mean, it's basically working with, in the case of anxiety, it's working with a therapist to expose yourself to the thing that you fear, whether that's fear of heights or fear of flying or fear of enclosed spaces or subways or vomiting or, you know, people have bizarre phobias of everything from rats to mayonnaise. But exposing yourself to it and then so learning that, you know, you can manage the fear and that it's not going to overwhelm you, and then sort of retraining your brain to have more positive and logical assessments of situations. I mean, this is where, again, the cognitive behavioral therapists sort of have their progenitors and philosophers going back to the Stoics, who, you know, they saw anxiety mainly as a logic problem. Mm-hmm. And if you have neurotic anxiety or an anxiety disorder, by definition, you're sort of worrying about things irrationally. So simply, if you can correct your thought patterns, you know, you will get better. And often people who have certain kinds of anxiety and depression will have this sort of inner dialogue of negative self-talk. You know, I'm a failure. I'm going to screw this up. And, you know, working with a therapist to try to overcome that, it can get into kind of new agey, cheesy affirmation style stuff, but it's shown to be very effective. There's a trait, and I can't remember if I mentioned this earlier, but, you know, related to neuropeptide Y, I mean, what neuropeptide Y is highly correlated with is a psychological trait that psychiatrists call resilience.
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be that when we were trying to figure out, you know, what makes mentally ill people mentally ill, you would study the mentally ill people. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But increasingly, researchers are also looking at, you know, why is it that not everyone develops anxiety, depression, and even some people who are exposed to extreme trauma are resistant to developing post-traumatic stress disorder. So they've been studying, you know, what makes those people so resilient, as the term of art is. And part of that, they've discovered, you know, is clearly genetic. If you're born with a lucky enough to be born with a high complement of NPY, neuropeptide Y, you will be much more resistant to developing post-traumatic stress disorder. Certain other genes also seem to, you know, inoculate you against it. But you can also teach yourself resilience. There's the expert on this is a psychiatrist, Dr. Dennis Charney, yep, who has, for instance, studied John McCain and other Vietnam veterans who were prisoners of the Hanoi Hilton for many years in Vietnam, basically POWs, and were subjected to, you know, torture and isolation and, you know, just a horrible experience for years at a time. And many of them, you know, came back and did not develop PTSD. And so, you know, he got interested in sort of studying, like, what accounts for that?
Yeah.
So he's ended up developing, you know, sort of this theory of resilience and also a resilience prescription. You know, yes, a certain amount of your resilience you're born with, and some of us are more resilient than others. But whenever I would say to my therapist in the book, Dr. W, like, I don't feel all that resilient, he'd say, first of all, you're much more resilient than you know.
Right.
But second of all, you can learn resilience. And so Dr. Charney says, you know, he has a thing called the resilience prescription. And he says, you know, learn to cultivate a positive attitude. You know, easier said than done, but it makes a big difference. Learn to, you know, again, this version of cognitive behavioral therapy, but you know, rethink events that you may think of as terrible are not necessarily so bad. Face your fears. Again, this is something that runs through many forms of anxiety treatment. You know, exposure. You need to don't run away from your fears, but try to confront them. And if you can do that and learn that you're okay with it, you know, that's the best way to develop resilience possible, because you're proving to yourself that you have these skills.
Yeah.
Have a broad and supportive social network. You know, even in the Hanoi Hilton, the POWs were able to kind of communicate with each other by knocking on the walls. And then, as you know, several of the callers have said, exercise.
Right.
You know, they would work out in the cells. And I have to say, you know, speaking from both personal experience and now the, you know, legions of studies that I've read, not only from, you know, cutting edge medical schools, but going back to like the 4th century BC, exercise is not only good for your physical health, but in all kinds of ways for your psychological health. So that can, you know, contribute to your physical and psychological well-being and help you stay resilient.
That was such an interesting part of the book where you talk about a lot of these people, they, as you said, they had optimism, but also they had having a moral compass or a set of beliefs that can't be shattered. That was an important part. Faith and spirituality was one of those characteristics that kept,
yep,
people healthy. Having a role model, and this one I thought was interesting, having a mission or a meaning in their life, having a sense of purpose was really important too.
Yep. Now, it was interesting to me thinking back again to my first book. So, as I mentioned, it was a biography of Sergeant Shriver, who founded the Peace Corps. And he was the most devout Catholic I've ever met, the most religious person I've ever met. And, you know, it's hard to say what's chicken and what's egg, you know,
yeah,
was his incredible. He was also the most confident, least anxious man and most idealistic person I've ever met. Maybe all of that was sort of physiologically conferred, and that led him to develop his deep faith. But he drew such consolation from his faith, and, you know, it gave him such a sense of a higher purpose. And, you know, he would worry about the things he should worry about, but he would always figure, like, you know, whatever happens, happens, it's in God's hands. And he had this, you know, tremendous sense of optimism and wanting to help other people. And, you know, I try to learn from that. I'm sort of a reluctant agnostic myself, but have tried, you know, starting way back then, but, you know, including now, trying to sort of grope my way to that kind of faith or belief in a higher power, because that comes along with it, you know, having a sense of goals and a personal moral compass, those other traits you mentioned that are so crucial to resilience.
Mm. So what do you figure, I mean, you were hoping, you say, to get to sort of an uplifting end to your book. You say, and you wanted to say that you were finding some sense of recovery for yourself, and then you're talking to your doctor, Dr. W., you talk about how, despite all of the things that you were learning along the way, you know, about, you know, neurobiology and all these environmental factors and resiliency and all that stuff, you told him that you still didn't feel much capacity for resilience. We talk about that story, if you would, because I wanted you to give us a sense of what he said about that.
Well, I mean, for one hand, he said, you know, and this is a classic, I guess, hallmark of people with anxiety disorders. You know, there's the internal self-perception is sort of at odds with the external reality of what you're actually able to, you know, achieve, and vice versa. And that's, again, gets to, you know, earlier on you were talking about, you know, the fear of coming out and the gap between, you know, inside and outside. He talks about kind of impression management. And if you feel internally like you're a fraud or like you're weak or vulnerable, you have to put all this work into impression management, which is, you know, sort of a symptom of the anxiety, but is also kind of exhausting because you're always trying to hide your anxiety. But he said, you know, first of all, you're already more resilient than you know, and would try to get me to, you know, take in the things that I had, you know, endured and gone through. And, you know, in fact, finishing the book was a sort of empowering thing. It is true. You know, I was worried about, you know, I sort of, when I embarked on the book, I thought, you know, it'd be great if it had this dramatic moral arc where, you know, I start out anxious and then I go through the crucible and I come out the other side and I'm cured. But in fact, you know, several years into the project, I'm starting to worry that, you know, year one, I'm anxious. Year two, I'm still anxious. Year three, I'm still anxious. And I'm thinking that's not an arc. That's like a flat line.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, I do, you know, continue to hold out hope that even if I, you know, I mean, maybe I can be cured. And Dr. W. believes that I can be, you know, quote unquote cured, but I have gotten better at managing these things and have come to terms with, as we were talking about earlier, some of the redeeming qualities of anxiety. And, you know, and then doing this book tour has been sort of protracted experience and exposure therapy doing. And I have to say the experience too of having so many people come forward after, you know, reading the book or the excerpt in The Atlantic and just to say, thank you. You know, I thought maybe there would be some of that, but I've been overwhelmed by the response. And I can't even articulate exactly, you know, how it's necessarily helping people, but in some ways it's making them feel better, just, I guess, to know that, A, you know, it's slightly limiting the stigma, showing that, you know, you can be, feel anxious and miserable inside and yet still, you know, be high functional and successful, and just provides the consolation of that you're not alone, which is what I felt, too, in discovering all these anxious people across history.
Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic Magazine, author of the book My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. We have a link to that on our website, also an excerpt to the article in The Atlantic. Go to radiowest.kuer.org to find that. Scott Stossel joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Scott, thank you very much for the time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music is composed by The Moth and the Flame. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.